Thank you, Alice. Our next speaker completed his legal studies at the University of Michigan School of Law in 1972. He's a professor of law at Louisiana State University Law Center, where he teaches constitutional law, criminal law, federal courts, and also jurisprudence. He served as a law clerk in federal district court, as an assistant U.S. attorney in New Orleans, as a consultant to the Justice Department, and also as a consultant to the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Separation of Powers. He has argued constitutional and criminal issues in various courts, including the United States Supreme Court. He was counsel in the famous Alabama Prayer case, otherwise known as Wallace versus Jaffrey, in 1985. Even though the Supreme Court overturned Judge Hand's decision in that case, Professor Baker won a major victory by persuading Chief Justice Rehnquist that the Supreme Court has been misinterpreting the Establishment Clause since 1947 and should reexamine all of its decisions. In addition to numerous articles, his writings include a number of books, The Intelligence Guide with Friedman, LaBar, and Chapman, forthcoming from Crown Books. Hall's Criminal Law, a casebook with Benson, Forrest, and George, now in its fifth edition, published by Mickey in Charlottesville, Virginia, and An Introduction to the Law of the United States, to be published, or which was published in 1992 by the University Press of America. Please put your hands together for Professor John Baker.
Thank you, Jim. Jim didn't mention that he was chief counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on Separation of Powers, and he was my boss at that time. So, given Ellis Sandoz's comments about what he was going to leave to me, I have to rush to assure you that this will not be a lawyer talk. So when the lights go out, you need not all leave. I don't intend to give a lawyer talk, by which I mean a rapid-fire series of cases spoken about on the assumption that you're all lawyers, or at least you should be lawyers. Instead, I do have another assumption, though, and that assumption is that most, if not all, people in this room, whether or not you're lawyers, are probably not too happy with the direction of the Supreme Court generally over the past 30 or 40 years, and in particular with the religion clauses, even though you may agree with this or that decision. Now, if you don't fit into that category, you might be more comfortable leaving and going to another meeting that is being held today in this very hotel. The American Bar Association Committee on Judicial Independence is meeting elsewhere in this hotel, and I think that you would find that the working assumption there is that religion has no place in modern life, but that everything the Supreme Court says is to be taken as gospel. What I want to do basically is divide what I'm going to say into three general headings, and I'm not going to rise to the bait that Ellis was throwing me at several points. We'll get into that later if we have any time left. But first of all, I want to talk about religion in the context of the structure of the Constitution and what the founders, I think, were trying to do. And then I want to talk about the political and social changes that occurred in the 19th century when there was, in fact, a clash between essentially Protestants and Catholics, which could have been avoided if, like Ellis, a Baptist, they all understood Aquinas, then there might not have been a problem. And third, then, I want to move into the court. For one thing, I want people to understand that the court actually comes to this very late, and that American pluralism is not the result of Supreme Court decisions. It is a result of a more complicated process that includes the history that you've heard about from both Bill and Ellis, and the particular way in which the Constitution was and was not structured. In the body of the Constitution itself, the one main thing that we get directed towards the issue of religion is that there shall be no religious test for office at the national level. Now, this can be looked at in an Enlightenment terms insofar as it is seen to be taking religion out of the public order. But it is also, I'm not endorsing that, I'm saying it can be looked at that way. But it is also very consistent with a whole series of mechanisms in the Constitution which distinguish between what is done at the state level and what is done at the federal level. And at the federal level, it was supposed to be that on which we all could agree and must agree to have a certain unity for those issues that could not be dealt with by the states but would have to be dealt with at the national level. The other thing that Congress did that is often overlooked but which we emphasize very much in the Jaffrey case was that the Constitution gives to Congress the power to, and this might seem strange at first, why it would have any bearing, gives Congress the power to regulate the admission of new states into the Union. This was put in because simultaneous with the meetings here in the summer of 1787 at Independence Hall, Congress was meeting in New York, and they had adopted something called the Northwest Ordinance. And Madison was not at all sure that the Continental Congress had that power, and by putting in this provision in the Constitution, it made it clear that at least the new government would have that power. And one of the early acts of the new Congress was to ratify the Northwest Ordinance. Why is the Northwest Ordinance important? Well, most public school teachers may know it because they think of it as establishing public schools in this country. Well, it didn't establish public schools in this country. It set aside land that was to be used for the promotion of education, morality, and religion. And that comes as very much news to many people because the Northwest Ordinance did two things. It said that new states coming into the Union had to have in their constitutions, that is, their state constitution, provisions for the free exercise of religion. But it did not require that there be a bar against an establishment of religion. I'll come back to that in just a minute. So what you have are three things simultaneously going on. That is, there will be no religion test, which is helpful to those who don't believe and those who are members of different religious groups than the dominant or majority group in a particular community. But that's only applicable at the national level. You have then, through the Northwest Ordinance, which will be applicable in the states, an assurance that all states coming into the Union will require that there be free exercise of religion. But you also have the principle established that it is justifiable to promote religion, but with this qualification. They took out of it the original notion that the promotion of religion could, initially, some wanted, by promoting the religion of the majority, and that for the majority was pulled out. And it's these different elements together, which are also elaborated in the Federalist Papers, that I believe to be the basis of our notion of pluralism. And it is not a notion of secularism. It is a notion of promoting a variety of existing religious beliefs. Now, there is embedded in all of this the notion that there can actually be an establishment and simultaneously be free exercise. That's important because I want to come back to it later. I'm not urging an establishment, but the barring of an establishment at the national level, but not the barring of it in the Northwest Ordinance, recognized that these two principles could coexist. And indeed, all of the states at the time, except Connecticut, had in their own constitutions provisions for free exercise, and yet a number of states had establishments. Now, there are degrees of establishment, but the operating principle here is that, yes, you can affirm, at least at the state level, the views of the majority and simultaneously protect the minority without turning the minority's view into that of the majority or making it necessarily a secular society. Now, the First Amendment really has almost nothing to do with the development of religious pluralism in this country because it isn't applied anywhere until roughly the 1940s. And so it comes as a surprise maybe to lawyers to think, well, how did we ever get relatively free exercise of religion in this case without the help of federal judges? I mean, how could the people themselves actually bring this about? I mean, you know, this would not seem to be something that was possible. Well, it is largely built in the design of the Constitution itself. There are a number of mechanisms in the constitutional structure that actually serve to dilute, if you will, the dominance of religion in certain aspects of public life long before any court ever got involved in this. For instance, much of the difficulties in the conflicts between religious groups came in Massachusetts. And I suppose that if the old Puritan establishment or what was left of it in Massachusetts could have done so, they would have kept those people from Ireland from landing on their shores and taking up residence there. But of course, the states lost their control of immigration. Moreover, the Commerce Clause meant that people could vote with their feet, they could leave, they could come in, and most importantly, once they became citizens, they could vote. And if you look at the history of Massachusetts, what you'll see is that as Catholics gained political power, there was a struggle, but they used their voting power to protect themselves. And out of that situation, we get into the second phase of what I wanted to talk about, and that's really the social structure that occurs in the 19th century and then carries over into the 20th century. And most of the problem regarding the religion clauses as a concrete matter was surrounded the question of schools. And when the Irish came into Massachusetts and the Know-Nothings were very strong in the 1850s, there is a clear attempt to force Catholics into public schools, and they viewed these schools as, quote, Christian schools, and that they would they weren't public schools at that point, they were common schools. They would indoctrinate them into the proper view of this country, which, of course, at that point was a Protestant view of things. The Catholics, in reaction, created their own parochial schools. Now, before these matters actually come into federal court in the 20th century, there is also the movement by Senator Blaine in the 1870s, I think it was, first of all, to get a national prohibition in the form of an amendment to the Constitution, which would have barred state establishments, and depending on the version you looked at, would have specifically barred aid to parochial schools. He didn't succeed with a constitutional amendment, but he did succeed insofar as, back to the Northwest Ordinance, new states coming into United States as states were required, because he had the power in the Senate at the time, to adopt Blaine amendments. And these Blaine amendments, which are largely in the western states, bar aid to parochial schools. Well, what you have is that the cultural change that's occurring here is kind of a standoff between Catholics and Protestants over the school issue. And Catholics are emphasizing free exercise issues, and they, if they happen to be in public schools, are not interested in having the Protestant version of the Bible shoved down their throat. And on the other hand, Protestants are not interested in subsidizing what they consider to be wrong-headed education in parochial schools. And it's against this kind of cultural background that the court begins to step into the matter And it does so in the 1940s. First of all, it does it on the free exercise clause, and then in the Everson case, it does it on the establishment clause. First of all, just a comment that I think it's erroneous to treat these two clauses apart from one another. And in fact, the two together make one whole, and it is the balance in the whole that one has to consider. And you might wonder, well, how do we get into this situation? And part of it is the fact that litigation proceeds by someone bringing a lawsuit, and the person bringing the lawsuit is not there to affirm the general principle. The person is there to litigate against a denial of a particular. So in early cases, and this is not a First Amendment case, but it's a due process case, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, you have Catholic schools that are resisting state educational requirements or restrictions on what they teach. But generally, the free exercise clause from the beginning up until this time had not been a great deal of problem, and indeed, until a few years ago when the Supreme Court decided a case from Oregon called the Smith case, there wasn't a great deal of conflict over the free exercise. Where most of the conflict has come has been in the Establishment Clause area. And in the Everson case in 1947, Justice Black wrote this opinion, and the particular result didn't seem to bother many people because he upheld the state's ability to provide bus transportation to parochial schools. But as the Supreme Court often does, it gives an acceptable result in a case where it develops a radically new doctrine. And that's what happened here in Everson. In Everson, Black went back, and he married two things that you really can't put together. He took Jefferson's view on separation of church-state, which is a view that Jefferson put forward in the state of Virginia. He didn't put he didn't think that the federal government had the power to interfere, and indeed it did not. He took that and joined it with what's called the incorporation issue, that is, the notion that the Bill of Rights, and in particular this clause, was incorporated under the Due Process Clause. And so from 1947 until the Jaffrey case, it was received orthodoxy in the teaching about the religion clauses that the intent of the framers was the same intent that Jefferson had in Virginia, even though Jefferson had nothing to do with the First Amendment. And the orthodoxy from Everson was that the First Amendment is all about separation of church and state, and therefore the state must be neutral on questions of religion. That was the view. And it was in the Jaffrey case that we challenged that view, and it was not only Justice Rehnquist in dissent who pointed out how fraudulent the Everson view was, but the real important step was that Justice Stevens, in his opinion for the majority, acknowledged for the first time that the history that they had put forward was in fact false. But Stevens also said this, at one time it was thought that this right to choose one's own creed merely prescribed the preference of one Christian sect over another. What he was referring to is the fact that at the outset, the view was what we would call no preference. That is, the Establishment Clause was just that. There was to be no preference for any particular religious sect by establishing that sect. Then he goes on to say, you know, we can't follow that view anymore. But he distorts what's going on. He says, but would not require equal respect for conscience of the infidel, the atheist, or the adherent of a non-Christian faith such as Mohammedanism or Judaism. There, he makes an absolutely false statement. He suggests that people who take the view of the founders were somehow intolerant people who were trying to cram Christianity down everybody's throat. And that was not at all true. And it was reflected in the writings by Justice Story, who served not only on the court, but also at Harvard Law School, and wrote the authoritative commentaries on the Constitution. The founders struck a balance. that protected the consciences of individuals without, in a sense, prostrating it, the views of the majority. It didn't mean that you had to purge the public square of all reference to religion. It meant that society, in promoting religious belief, and the founders generally believed that this was necessary for the maintenance of virtue in a society, that they could not, however, impose upon the conscience of individuals. And they didn't find any problem in balancing those two things. The problem we have today is created by the social welfare state. And many of the problems that arise are a product of the fact that government, both state and federal in particular, claim such broad-reaching powers and regulate so much of society that many of the religion issues that are raised today would not have been issues in the past. In response to this, various people have had various solutions. And this is where we come to the controversy, I guess, or where we come to division in our own ranks. There is this term before the Supreme Court, the so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was a response by Congress to a decision I mentioned earlier, the Smith case, in which the Supreme Court's view of free exercise cut back, some would say, on the view taken by earlier courts, and some would argue against the original understanding. And in an odd way, conservatives have been split over this, and many of the backers of the free exercise of this new act come from the religious right, but the other backers come from the ACLU. And when those two team up together, it makes me wonder what's going on here. And it points out that there are deep divisions here, and the time that it would take to go in more deeply into the particular possibilities of how you deal with this at this point will have to wait for another day. Thank you.